Well, okay, are we on?
Yeah, we're on now.
I see a continuity in your work of certain interests, and one is decorative objects, interior decorative objects, design, and architecture. And you said you were going to come back and talk about Wright, and certainly you had a long period where Wright was a complete influence on you, and the work in England was influenced by a certain kind of architecture.
Interestingly enough, yesterday I had a call from a woman at Taliesin, and she had seen some of my prints dealing with Wright's buildings and is interested in doing a poster. And I haven't dealt with that since probably 81. And so it's nice. I hope it happens. Well, I'm from Racine, Wisconsin, and that's where the Johnson Wax building is. And so my grandmother lived not too far from the building, and so I saw it frequently. I didn't understand it. It was a building with no windows. It didn't make sense to me. There was another house of his in Racine, the Hardy House, and it was on the lakeshore. And every time we drove to my grandmother's house, we'd go back and forth. And I thought it was a bathhouse because it was right on Lake Michigan. And it, again, had no windows. It had a clear story. And I never saw what was supposed to be the front of a house should face the street. And you sit on your porch and you watch people go by and you look out on the street. And so this building, it was plaster and wood, and I thought it was a bathhouse. I never knew that around the front of it were these wonderful windows that looked out over the lake, because there wasn't access to that beach there.
There was no front porch.
No, but the house next to it had a big front porch. So those are my associations with Wright. I came to know later on. I thought Wright was incredibly unique. I still do, but I didn't realize till I went to England. I mean, you have to realize I was pretty young, and I saw the Art Deco buildings. We now call it Art Deco. I think it took a while before that term was really used. It was called Art Moderne. I saw the connection with Wright. Wright just didn't pop up all by himself, though he would like to tell you he did. There were precedents for his later work. It was his later work that used those elements. The early prairie houses, of course, had no relationship. But that's when these elements started coming into my work, and I would look at buildings in England and started doing prints using this Art Deco, very, very stark, very erasing everything that might be around a building and making the building itself this very beautiful object. So that's how I started to work, and that started in London. Much later, when I went to Paris, I started looking at the buildings in Paris from this period, which were quite different but related, so I was working on series from those buildings. At some point, I was approached by Karen Boyd, that's her name at the moment, but Karen Johnson Boyd, who was the daughter of Sam Johnson. Wait a minute, isn't Sam? Sam is her brother.
Was it
H.F.?
H.F. Johnson, yeah. Herbert, I think it was Herbert.
Herbert, yeah.
Okay. Karen approached me. She wanted a very unique birthday present for her father, and she asked me if I would do a print of the Johnson Wax building. And that started me on the Frank Lloyd Wright buildings. Working in the same way, she had seen my work and thought it very appropriate to the Johnson Wax building, which it was, but it was sort of early inspired by B. buildings I had seen in England. So after I did that print, she asked me if I would like to make more of the Wright's buildings and do a portfolio. So I did. I did the Guggenheim, Taliesin West. I did her house, the house she grew up in Racine, Wingspread. And I did the Civic Center in San Rafael, California, which is quite a marvelous building.
Falling Water.
And the Falling Water wasn't part of that group. No. That was later.
It's the house in Hollywood.
And that was later, too, the Hollyhock House.
Hollyhock.
So I did six prints for her, and then we had a beautiful box made in Chicago at Elizabeth Nair's workshop. And so there's this beautiful portfolio that...
Did you visit each of the sites?
Yes. Oh, yes. I went out and I took a lot of pictures of each place. And then I would work with reference to the photograph, but never photographically. I never used a photo process. But I would... I would take a lot of shots and sort of use an angle that where the building was like an object, and it was a very sculptural object and rather stark, and with no outside distractions. Included the environment, no clouds.
Did you do Taliesin West?
Yes, I think I said that.
That was part of the portfolio.
Yes, it was. Oh, I know. I did Unity Temple in Oak Park, Illinois. It was a Unitarian meeting house, which was a really beautiful building. It was done in 1905, and it predated Mondrian, and it's like a Mondrian painting when you reduce all the linear elements and the abstraction. The interior of that building is like a painting. It's like an abstract painting. It's like a Mondrian, but it was done before Mondrian was in that abstract period. So I continued for a couple of years doing Wright images. It was the way I worked was very painstaking and slow. So I didn't do a huge amount of work, but a largish body of work. And then
is while you're still in London, or?
No, excuse me, I returned. No, the London work started me out, and then when I came back, shortly after, later. But I was continuing to do the architectural work for quite a long time. I think I met Karen in 1979. So it would have been some years later, but I had continued working in this vein. And so then started the Wright series. And then I felt a little that I was too much identified with Wright, you know, that the work was getting more attention for Wright than for me. That's one thing. And then I didn't want to work that way anymore. I didn't want to deal with that imagery, and I didn't want to work in such a painstaking way. Though I continued working on postmodern architectural images, there were some, a Japanese architect named Aida, A-I-D-A, and his work is really strange and marvelous and has that kind of pared down simplicity, building as object kind of look. So I did some images of his buildings. And then I would go to New York and started doing some skyscrapers and looking at American Art Deco. And there are a lot of skyscrapers that used that style. So I did the Chrysler Building, and I did a Greyhound bus station in Washington, D.C., and one in Bethesda, Maryland. They were wonderful buildings that have long since been torn down, but wonderful, simple Art Deco buildings with, of course, the Greyhound image, usually in some kind of wonderful Art Deco tower.
How do you feel about visual artists doing the architecture? In essence, you're using somebody else's design to make your art. Does that ever enter into any of your considerations? You just, it was like a natural object, it'd be like a landscape, only it was an architecture.
Yeah, I never had any conflict or even thought much about that. I mean, other artists might go out and draw a room. If I drew that lamp, is there a conflict about that?
Yeah.
Or it's just like a still life.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I really, since an early child, I reacted very strongly to my living environment, to buildings. I was always very aware of what was around me as far as buildings. I always noticed, and not the trees, I noticed the buildings. So this was something that was very natural to me, to comment on my surroundings and to pick out something I considered beautiful but not pretty. And there was something about Wright's work and the buildings I chose that was curious. There is something curious about the angle I would take. Perhaps 5% of them didn't have that element, but when I think I really excelled was when I found this kind of curious spatial formal element. So I was really, it was this very formal to me. The shapes were extremely important and the whole design. So that was what I was interested in, and the idea of house, building, shelter, environment. So
the angle you take becomes the arrangement then.
Exactly.
And that's the art.
Yeah, yeah.
From your
perspective. I was designing by moving around a three-dimensional structure.
And the emphasis, too. In other words, you wouldn't do these things straight.
No.
A certain amount of rearranging, but there was a shift of emphasis, it seems to me, in some of them.
Yes, I remember that Warrington had a student named Jane Goldman who was commissioned to do a print of the Union. And, I looked at her print and it was straight. I never would have done a print like that. I would have found some odd angle that would have transformed it into mine instead of a straight. I would just never say, here's a building. And in fact, Sam Johnson wants me to do this school that he had built in Racine this summer, wants me to do a print and asked me if I, still would consider working that way, the way I had in the past, and I would prefer not to, but I think I'm going to do it. Just really, I feel like I should. So I'll be going down there this summer and seeing what this building looks like.
So you're just looking for something different, or you're trying to look for the soul of the building, or what is it exactly when you see the right angle? What are you saying?
Well, first of all, I choose a building that has something quirky about it.
Right.
And I was interested in, really, it's like a Brancusi sculpture. You know, the simplicity of the form and the sort of odd angles, the movement that in a Brancusi sculpture. That's how I looked at those. That's why I was so interested in Art Deco. They had that kind of grace but quirkiness and this kind of flowing line, these simple forms, but then there was an oddity about them. So that's what interests me formally. And then there's the my...
Yeah, so. I know what you mean. Wright is such a daring architect. In a way, he was really taking chances, it seems to me, in his best buildings. And so you walk around the building, you go through the building, and then suddenly you begin to see the chance that he took. You know, and I have that feeling about Taliesin here. And I had the chance to do that little cover for the Wisconsin Academy, and I worked right in. And the daring thing about that are these cantilevered balconies that really should fall down. You know, I've been out on that in his apartment, in Tallahassee.
Well, yours shows it cracking.
I did crack it, yeah. Because that's what I felt.
It has cracks in it, and it should fall.
It does have cracks in it.
They need a long pole.
You go out on the end of that cantilevered, ridiculously cantilevered balcony, and it is kind of drooping at the end. And you don't stay out there very long.
Yeah.
You go back inside. It seems to me that's sort of the thing that you search out in the right buildings.
Yeah, I wanted to say there's another person who, another artist that refers to my work, which is after the fact, is the sculptor David Smith, who worked in welded steel and aluminum, and he would, very abstract, he would weld these parts together which should not be supported. They should fall over, but they were welded into place. So there's this odd weight and angle to his work, and it's the same thing that I see in my work of that period.
Yeah, of course, the Johnson Wax building, they thought that was going to collapse, you know, before they let him go ahead and build it. They had to test these lopsided pillars, and to everyone's amazement, they held up under all the weight that they piled on. Well, let's move on. In your work, how did you make the transition from the right things? And then there were some things that were in line with that. I remember there was a theater in San Francisco, for example. And then your work, it got romantic. I'm thinking of the Mexican Aquatints.
Oh, yeah. 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 There were some ruins in Mexico that I did some prints of. There were sand dunes in Colorado that I did some prints of. But they had the same kind of look. They were so sculptured by the wind, and they had just sort of were these strange shapes that would overlap each other visually. I mean, in reality, they didn't, but when you were looking straight on, there would be these form in front of form in front of forms. So I worked a while in that area.
So you feel they really are close to what you were doing.
They are, and I was working in pure aquatint at that time. This will shed a little light, so that it was, there were no line elements in the work at all. It was purely shape rendered with this tonal technique one can use in etching, a very fine tonal surface that blends from dark to light to white. And so that I was simplifying the technical part of my work was very much simplified to suit the shapes. Now that wasn't consistent in everything at that time, but pretty much that was how I worked. So that I was just paring everything down on the way I worked and the image I was working with to pure shape. Then as I was moving out of the Wright period, it happened that I taught one summer at Madison. There's another piece in there. Oh, I know. I had spent some time back in San Francisco. I had taught at Mills College in Oakland and lived in San Francisco, so that I spent a lot of time in the Marina area of San Francisco, where the whole Marina was landfill, I believe, a filling in the bay, and that whole area was built at the same time, and it suffered a lot of damage in the last earthquake about 6 years ago. And anyway, intriguing little bungalows, not so little, some of them, but with the garage right up front or underneath, and built on a slight hill so that the living room would be up high and the garage underneath. And the garage and the plantings, these sort of round bush shapes, sort of carried my visual sensibility into another realm of architecture. So I did quite a lot of work on these really strange, curious buildings in the Marina. And that led me to, I taught off and on at Madison at this period, And in 84, I think it was 84, I taught full-time for a semester or a year. I'd have to check my bio. And I had a student who was working in Xerox, a lot in Xerox. And so I explored, I was interested in what she was doing. And so there was a copy center in the Humanities Building, which not only have a lot of Xerox machines, but it had a color copy machine. It had a Xerox copy machine. This was a species that was designed in the early 70s, and there was nothing else around. 3M had had a color copier, but they had pulled them all in. They thought it was a technology going nowhere. And Xerox had this very old technology, which broke down all the time. You'd go down, and there's a nice young man named Gary down there, and so I would rent time on the copier with him. He would be working with me. So I started taking my small etchings. I'd done some very small etchings of these buildings in San Francisco, and I started working them on the color Xerox machine. And it was a kind of machine that had three slow passes of color, one at a time, you know, red, yellow, and blue. Didn't have black. And so you could put one image on, whip it off, put another image on, whip it off, all in the time that it took to pass. So you could do these multi-layer things. You could play around with the color. You could put textures. I had this real sparkly piece of cloth that I'd put in, and it reacted in the most marvelous way. So I'd create different textures. I had been working, as I said, with these very smooth, classic areas of shapes. And I found out I was starved for texture. So I started building texture into the work with this process. And then I started, I spent 2 years playing around with the color Xerox machine. And things that one now can do so fast on the computer were so hard to do on the copy machine. I would take an image that I was very interested in and have it printed on a transparency. I would cut this transparency into 2x2 pieces, put them in glass slide cases, and then there was an adapter that went on the color Xerox machine that you could put a slide in, and then I would take a slide of each of these sections, trim them down later, and put them together so I could have a big piece. Well, you almost still have to do this with a computer, but there is a program called PosterWorks that one can do it very quickly. But it was fascinating to me to use technology, and it remains fascinating to me. And I'm going to Kinko's today. I have an idea that I want to work on. So
Output from the Xerox hold up at all, or is the color fade, or is it still fresh?
It seems fresh to me. Now, a lot of these things I haven't left on the wall for years,
yeah.
But when I look at them, they're still fine.
Not the day glow.
Well, no. These things surprise you. For example, I have, through the years, I've made Xerox copies of my press clippings. And I was going through the archives the other day. The press clippings from the newspaper are almost unreadable.
Yeah,
right. They're brown, some
yes.
of them,
yes.
you hold them up and they turn into dust before your very eyes. Whereas the Xerox are clean, white, and crisp.
Yeah.
20 years old, maybe 30 years old.
I just wonder about the color fading.
Well, no, the color is encased in plastic. So I don't think that's much the problem. Or less problem, and maybe it is, but it is encased in plastic. It's sealed. No, there's the toner, and then there's the whatever it is that makes it bond is plastic. So, well, not that a plastic is always, but the Xerox people, and I would see a lot of them. They'd come in to repair these machines and talk to them about that, and they thought it was pretty permanent, but they couldn't give me an outside date. But I would feed rag papers through. I mean, I did not use Xerox paper. I used all kinds of Japanese papers. And there was a paper that's available from Ico's in Chicago, which has the most wonderful papers I've ever seen anywhere. And it is actually a very thin slice of wood. And it's mounted on minuscule backing, and in fact, I'm not even sure it is. It is wood. And I was very fond of working on that. And one day, I set the machine on fire. And so I didn't appear too often after that. I got out real fast. But just after that, I taught at the University of California at Berkeley for a semester. And so in their student union, they had a color Xerox machine. So I got real friendly with the operator. And he worked with me there, and I was continuing doing the Xerox imagery. And if I didn't set his Xerox machine on fire, too, I mean, the smoke starts coming out and he quick opened the door, and we both blew into it. And I never went back after that. I was so embarrassed.
Burning your bridges.
So you're going to Kinko's this afternoon. Yeah.
They don't let you near their color machines.
Is this the image you were projecting?
Yeah, it's a very hot image, yeah.
So really, you are probably the first technology-oriented printmaker in this area, right? I mean, your Xerox is... are direct lead into your work in computers now.
Oh yeah, I have used Xerox off and on ever since, and now I'm using engineering copiers and of course the computer.
So Wiggy has been following your lead.
Well, I don't know what his early involvement with technology is. I know in the last 2 years he's been very involved, but I don't know. But I started.
What about students? Your students, are they involved in technology?
I have a coterie of students who are crazed about technology and who spend a lot of times on computer, a lot of time on computers. And I have other students who aren't at all interested. They're here to do fine art, and they're not here to use, you know, technology or to use some kind of machine to make the art on. They want to make it themselves. So it's not a problem. More and more, I just learned computers a year ago. So I started integrating it into my teaching, and next year it will be much more integrated into my teaching. This year I used it very spontaneously. When something came up that I could see something on the computer would really help the work or lead somewhere else, I would suggest it. And I had my graduate students do a project over at the New Media Center. So they did a collaboration there because they have computers side by side and they could work on two screens and import, you know, we'd have the same material up on each screen side by side, and they could scan the two different works in and overlay them and move them around, and so they did some very interesting works. So that was a project, but I'm going to have routinely projects now in my classes that will include computer-generated art that will be part of etching, which is mostly what I teach. Not replace it, but be part of. More and more job descriptions for college teaching include knowledge of the computer. Mm-hmm. So it's important for them to know how to do this. But backing up, maybe I shouldn't back up. I don't know how much more time we have because there are...
Well, you've got another session, too.
Yeah. So maybe I can talk about the recent computer work there. But, okay, after the Xerox work, I taught this course in the department.
Never duplicate in this town again.
Well, actually, then I got the use of there was another another color Xerox machine on campus, so I got the use of both of these for a course, or a short two-week course in color Xerox. Now, this was right at the end of the period I was using the computer, color Xerox. So I was gathering material to demonstrate to the students this kind of overlaying, and that you can put three-dimensional objects on the screen. And so I had this little figurine of Wonder Woman sitting on my desk from a birthday cake that someone had surprised me with, and there had been candles on the cake, and so the poor Wonder Woman, her arms are up like this and they were kind of burnt. And so I ran this through the color Xerox machine and I came up with this incredible figure, this sort of sad heroine. Anyway, I started playing around then with Wonder Woman and the image of Wonder Woman, and started looking at old comic books and buying some vintage comic books and working around drawing, monoprinting, a lot of drawing, sort of using kind of the style of Wonder Woman, but putting her in strange situations. And oddly enough, one image I remember is a sculpture of David Smith in charcoal, and Wonder Woman's whizzing by and doing a second look back at this sculpture, which is like looks like it should be tipping over and falling down. And then there were natural disasters that Wonder Woman would go whizzing by again and look at these. Oh, look what's happening! So I was really having fun, as you might imagine. This was a huge switch from what I'd been doing, and I was ready for a switch. So. So I was working with the image of Wonder Woman for about 6 months, and then I had to do a print for a portfolio of former students at Madison. So I had some old linoleum in the attic. Didn't know what I was going to do. Had been working in many medium at this time. I had sort of not been doing etching for a while. So I started doing a linoleum cut of Wonder Woman. And I had recently been to Greece, to Mycenae, where there were restoring an old temple. And there were these wonderful pillars. And they were like postmodern architecture. I mean, this must be what postmodern architects looked at, because they were extremely interesting. So the idea of Wonder Woman and these pillars and Christ in the temple and Wonder Woman sort of taking the place of Christ started there. So the image was Wonder Woman tied up with her golden lasso, which is the only way she can be controlled or captured. So there she was, standing in for Christ with a crown of thorns and with these pillars swiped from Mycenae. And that started the series where Wonder Woman became this pseudo-religious figure. And so I did a large group of work on this, where there was the resurrection and the ascension. I never did a crucifixion. I restrained myself. But then there were other scenes of Wonder Woman saving people from disaster. And it was my own Wonder Woman. It sort of resembled the Wonder Woman of my childhood. Now, I had collected Wonder Woman comic books when I was young. We all did. We had piles of them in our basement. And instead of watching television, we'd be reading comic books when we were like 8 years old and 9 years old. And unfortunately, I never saved those comic books. I'm sure my mother threw them out as fast as she could. But we used to trade them around the neighborhood. You know, you have a stack, it's always trade by the foot. And so bringing back that period, and then my Catholic education, where I went to Catholic schools for 14 years, with my contemporary attitudes and the feminist revolution, and tying all these things up into these images at this point. So in a way, I was returning to figuration. I hadn't dealt with the figure for a long, long time, but in the beginning, I did nothing but. So it wasn't totally surprising, though I did surprise a lot of people with that print. So it was an interesting series, and I got a lot of reaction to it. I mean, people really warmed up to this work and found it very interesting. And I would do things like, instead of, actually, Wonder Woman was coming off the cross. There was no cross, but she was coming. I did a Pietà, where Wonder Woman is, instead of being cradled by these soft women in soft robes, she got the starving Buddha image, so this bony Buddha is taking Wonder Woman, and they're all, there was a punk figure, kind of menacing punk figure, and snakes and lights and things going on. So I'm recreating these biblical images to my own liking and making feminist statements. You know, I don't do that purposely. Now I'm a feminist, but it was just, you know, it was taking Wonder Woman, taking religion, somehow you're going to be thinking about these issues. And sort of from the 70s, you hardly can forget the change. I mean, the change took place in my lifetime, in my mature lifetime, that feminism brought about. So it's something that I see without trying, because I can see the differences. I think young women today don't really, a lot of them don't understand that someone had to take a position on these issues. I mean, there's still a lot of feminists around and feminist actions. In fact, it's in my life, it seems inevitable that I deal with women who are involved in these issues all the time. But I don't see that much in my students. They don't seem to. Students are not very political, for one thing. So.
Is this a recent?
Yeah, I am talking about recently. Yeah. Anyway, so I dealt with that theme for a number of years, and sort of had said what I had to say, and did a body of work, which it now seems that the changes I make in my work, the precedents are all there, and I circle around, but I pick up precedents that I have laid down, obviously things that interest me. They aren't always consecutive. I might go back to, for instance, rather recently, around 1990, I started dealing with the persona of Saint Teresa, and of Avila, as a Spanish nun, mystic, and I have no religious attitudes toward this, but I realized that Catholicism is part of my culture, and that maybe it's okay to deal with this, that I could rationally deal with this all right. But it's not about religion, but it's about Saint Teresa, and it's about all the trappings having to do with ritual in the Catholic Church, and that's kind of what I'm dealing with now. I'm moving out of the relationship of ritual to work, to church, but having to do with ritual in everyday life, with the things we use and the way we ritually present things like food, and that's a big theme in my work, is the fact that we put on nice tablecloths and then we eat a slaughtered animal. So that's kind of where I am now.
But you are not vegetarian.
No, I buy into this.
You join the ritual.
Yes, but I understand what I'm doing, and I, you know, don't. I don't really like what has to happen for this ritual to take place.
But pray before you eat, then.
I pray for the animal. Yeah, I pray for the soul of the animal.
I'd like to ask you one more question. I know we're starting to run a little late here, but we've talked over the throughout the course of these interviews about, with all male artists up to you, about how art was predominantly male-oriented, at least here at the university in the earlier years, post-World War II years. How have you seen that change? Matt, all of the people you mentioned earlier in your interview were males, and then I heard more and more female, mostly all of them, I heard more and
yeah.
more female artists'
yeah.
names mentioned as you went along. How
yeah.
has the field changed in that regard during your career as an artist?
Well, wonderfully so. And in fact, I've started to bring in particular artists for my students who have some connection to the print area, and there are wonderful women, and I will only bring in women. It's such a male-oriented program still here that I feel it's one of my missions to bring in really successful women like June Wayne and Phyllis Bramson. Well, yes, as students, as undergrads, I almost have to digress to my childhood, where I had one brother and three sisters, and kind of the only male, and he got very special treatment from my mother. My father had died quite young, so I saw this growing up, and it always kind of was so curious to me. And so I was always, all my life, and then my colleagues in art school, we were always talking about this issue, and realizing we had to be better than the men to make any impact at all, but we always had to be better, and then we allowed as we were. So it was a strange time to a student who, a female student here now, wouldn't quite understand the attitude. It was a very paternalistic, slightly sexual attitude. Sessler liked women a lot. He always treated women differently than men. He, you know, was a proper man, but there was that you were treated differently. You weren't student A and student B. You were a female student, and in general, much wasn't expected of you. You would get married and have children, and maybe you'd collect or do it as a hobby. So there was this built-in attitude. I'm talking about as an undergraduate, a male professor's. Toward women, and there were probably a few exceptions, but it began to change gradually, but it took the feminist revolution in the 70s for things to begin to change. And of course in the art world things didn't change much at all. I mean, there had always been successful women artists. It wasn't that there were zero, but it's just that the proportions were very, very poor. And it was, as I once said, growing up, male alcoholic artists in their 40s were those that were being recognized by the art community in New York. And I could try to be, I would someday be 40. I could be alcoholic, but I would never be a male. So. So that was my perception of artists when I was in school, that was it. They were male, alcoholic, and 40. But you know, my friends and I figured we were going to be different. I mean, we really did think that we were different, but it wasn't the kind of community that women now have and understand that they've got to support themselves. That was pre-feminist thinking, that I uniquely am different, and now you think we as a group have to work together to change things. Things haven't changed that much in the art department. I am the only woman in the graphics area. I hope we can change that soon, when and if we get new positions. But it is something that one has had to deal with most of one's life, and it gets better, constantly gets better. Anything more specific?
This might be a good time. Yeah, we'll pick it up at the studio.
Right.
Sometimes.